Welcome to the podcast for the Journal of the American Academy of Physician Assistants. Welcome to the JAPA podcast for the June 2020 issue. In this podcast, we summarize select articles from this month's JAPA. I'm your co-host, Christopher Madej, Program Director at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center PA program in Memphis, Tennessee.
And I'm your co-host, Adrienne Banning, faculty member at the Drexel PA program in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. This month, we feature CME articles on PCI in stable angina and HIV PrEP, PEP, a review article on cancer pain treatment, and a QRS on schizophrenia spectrum disorders.
But first, we have our question from the editor. And Harrison sent us a question revolving around COVID-19, the pandemic, how it's changing healthcare and really life in general for everybody in the United States and probably everybody worldwide, and that there are a lot of lessons that are being learned from this. And this question specifically was, what's one thing that has occurred during this COVID pandemic that we think should continue after life moves forward in a previous sense of quote-unquote normalcy? And Adrian and I were discussing before we started recording, and we thought that this is also a good opportunity to talk about everything that is going on in the U.S. society right now revolving racism, anti-racism, systemic oppression, and everything that has been coming up in the news. And we thought that this would be a good opportunity for us to discuss our thoughts about how we feel like we should move forward, not just from a COVID standpoint, but just from a United States society standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, we prep these podcasts ahead of time, of course. And Harrison did say, you know, make this about, as things evolve, what you want it to be about. Discuss George Floyd, discuss the killings that have gone on. And Chris and I didn't want to prepare this kind of formalized statement that, you know, all of our inboxes get flooded with during COVID. Here's what our company is doing at this time. Here's what we've learned for COVID. And then a similar round of emails of anti-racism sentiment. Here is what our company believes. Here's what we're doing going forward, which are important, that people recognize that action needs to be taken and that they're doing it and that they're letting people know. I appreciate that. And yet we wanted to just be really genuine and kind of speak off the cuff here. So we're not perfect. Forgive us if we use words that, I don't know, maybe weren't the words that you would use, but we're trying to be genuine in discussing how we recognize whatever intentions in our profession and individually have gone out, they're not enough. They haven't been anti-racist enough. We are not a very diverse profession. We don't have a lot of shared voices. We don't have a lot of Black voices, and we have an election going on right now for leadership in AAPA. So I think to address Harrison's kind of the heart of Harrison's question on, you know, what should continue as we move forward in this time, let's say this springtime. I don't want to go back to a lot of normal. I want to see my students in person, and I want to teach them physical exam skills in person. I don't know if everything has to be done in the office. I think that we've learned how to approach EBM, but I don't want to go back to tiptoeing around racism and the ridiculous deficits it creates in American health. Every month we talk about diseases and illness and socioeconomic problems that the situation is worse in the Black population every single month. And I think I don't ever want to go back to not actively fighting against that and fighting against racism.
No, I would echo that. I think the big thing that I have learned, again, coming from a white male, is it's not enough to just not be racist. You need to be anti-racist, and you need to call out things when you see it. Don't turn a blind eye and say, okay, well, I would never do that, or I don't support that, but I'm not going to say anything in that particular format. You know, one of the things that comes up that I think about a lot is, you know, my family is Jewish. My wife is Jewish. We attend synagogue. And when the anti-Semitic banter that was going on several months ago and the shootings that were occurring in the synagogue, you know, people were saying, oh, this is awful, this is awful. And then you look back at what happened during Nazi Germany. People may not have been 100% on board with Hitler's agenda, but they also didn't do anything to combat what was going on either. And I think that you really do tread on very thin ice between being complacent and not doing things versus being active in fighting against. And I think there is a cohort that we very much need to be cognizant and vocal and fight some of the things that are coming out that maybe, as at least speaking for me, I might not have seen, witnessed, or even known about.
Right. I think this is a time that we can educate ourselves, especially white people can educate themselves more than ever before. It's not the work of your black colleagues or friends to do that for you. And Chris, you touched on a point, you know, as we've seen even over the past several years, divides created based on what group someone might belong to in any sense. One of the ways that we know that we can combat that is to speak up. The people who are against oppression sometimes are very lonely in expressing that, and then they get taken down as well with the oppression. But if many of us feel that way, then when we say it together, then we're the majority and we can support each other that way. So actively stepping in and being an active, even bystander, speaking up when you see something wrong and educating yourself there, it might seem like a small step, but it's cumulative. And that's, to summarize and not go on, that's what I hope that we can continue with going forward. We have seen a lot of pain in the past couple months, but I think we've also recognized that there's a lot of opportunity.
Yep. And anything that you do that's a step forward is the right move. And it doesn't necessarily need to be, you know, drastically life-changing and, you know, you're taking on a ginormous mantle, but it's just, it's being more vocal. It's being more observant. It's when you see something, call it out, and actively support your colleagues, mm-hmm. your friends, your family. You know, don't just assume that, oh, well, I don't participate in racist comments or banter or anything else, so therefore I am not racist. It is supporting your friends and your colleagues and saying, you have an ally with me. If there's anything I can do, please let me know, and have those frank conversations that, you know, as everybody has said, a lot of times they're difficult, but difficult conversations are where change occurs. It's where you mm-hmm. grow as an individual. It's how we grow as a society. And I think that that's what I would like to see us as a country mm-hmm. move forward with, is just being more united, being more supportive, and not having the division that we have seen over the last several years really cause a, you know, potential non-repairable rift, you know, in our country and in our society.
Yeah, and like almost everything else, this affects, this is our lane as PAs. Mm-hmm. I don't think that we can say anymore, oh, I don't want to get political, I'll stay out of that. What if I say the wrong thing or mess up? Like, okay, we all will. You, especially if you're learning a new way to have a conversation like this, mm-hmm. sure, we're gonna say the wrong things and mess up, but it's more important than not saying anything at mm-hmm. all. This is definitely This is our realm.
Yep.
So, okay. Yeah. That's how we're feeling.
Yep.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for letting us let us get our thoughts out to the airwaves. You know, again, part of what the question for the editor is designed to do is to let you as the listener get into the minds of us as the co-hosts. And this is an opportunity for us to say what we've been thinking. We appreciate the opportunity for you to listen to what we have to say about it. And, you know, with that, we'll go ahead and jump into the JAPA podcast.
It does transition to the disclaimer because they are our thoughts. No one told us what to say or to say these things. The podcast is a summary of select articles from this month's JAPA. There are opinions. They don't represent. We don't resent anyone, really, but they don't represent JAPA, the authors or the editors' opinions or the publisher, and this is not intended as medical advice.
Yeah, and, you know, don't forget there is CME to be had through the journal, and we do review those CME articles to make it that much easier for you to log those credits. So after you listen to us talk about the articles, go and review the post-test, take the online quiz, get a 70%, and log your Category 1 CME.
Mm-hmm. This is June. It is Pride Month. Happy Pride Month. We are going to start out with an article that is applicable to our community and to the Pride community. And we just had a big Supreme Court decision yesterday come through. That would be, today is June 16th, so that was June 15th. And this is an update on HIV prevention and pre-exposure prophylaxis by Jonathan Baker, who practices at Laser Surgery Care in New York. He is the American Academy of PA's liaison to GLAMA, Health Professionals Advancing LGBTQ Equality, and a past president of the Lesbian, Bisexual, Gay, and Transgender PA Caucus. And it is also by co-author Joanne Rolls, who is an assistant clinical professor in the PA program at the University of Utah School of Medicine in Salt Lake City, Utah, and co-founder and education director of the university's Transgender Health Program. And the authors have disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. So we're talking about PrEP, which is HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis. It's used by patients without HIV to reduce their risk of getting HIV for those at risk. I like that the authors say that as one of the only providers with prescribing privileges, we have an obligation to understand and manage PrEP, and it is fundamental to reducing HIV infections. Obligation and fundamental. Here are the key points right off the bat that I think the authors and I would like you to take away from this. HIV prevention is the responsibility of healthcare providers with prescriptive authority, especially those in primary care. HIV prevention options vary and meet the needs of diverse patient populations. So we'll talk about this in a second, but it's really about sexual practices and not a group that someone identifies with, but what types of practices they're doing. And we're talking about two meds and their tenofovir-based PrEP for HIV. It's highly effective, safe, and easy to manage and in primary care. So if you're in primary care, this article summary is for you. PrEP reduces HIV in at-risk populations by 44 to 73%, but up to 100% in studies in the most adherent groups. Very effective. I've already said that we want to assess risk by individual behaviors and not population-level characteristics, but we are going to talk about some more at-risk groups in just a second. All of this means, though, that you need to have open, patient-centered, compassionate sexual health conversations. If it's something that you're not comfortable with, practice a little bit, get comfortable, and we really just need to have the conversation so that we can move forward in prescribing this medication. A little bit about HIV incidence. That's new cases in a time frame. There's incidence and prevalence, and sometimes those things get confused. Incidence is how many new cases that we have in a certain time frame. Prevalence is how many people are out there living with a diagnosis at the time. Incidence of HIV is stable at around 40,000 cases per year, but broken down, rates are down, going down in certain groups. They're down about 17% in people who inject drugs. They're down about 8% in heterosexuals, They're stable in men who have sex with men, Black and Hispanic patients, but up in men who have sex with men aged 25 to 34, Hispanic men who have sex with men, and American Indian, Alaska Native, and Asian populations. So incidence is not decreasing in all populations, and they're your patients that you're going to want to recognize at higher risk where incidence is going up. Also, in the south of the United States, which is 37% of the U.S. population, it's 50% of the HIV incidence cases. So know where you're living and know the incidence of HIV where you are. States with the lowest use of PrEP have seen an increase in HIV diagnosis. The reverse, states with the highest use have seen a 23% decrease. It works. About 1.1 million people over the age of 13 are living with HIV, so that's the prevalence, and about 15% don't know it. So quick math, that's 165,000 people have HIV and don't know it. A little aside here, not from the article, but I wanted to share with you, the USPSTF recommends screening everyone for HIV at age 15 and over, and then annual screening in people who are sexually active. So that's a lot of screening. We're going to talk more about specific screening in patients taking PrEP too in a little bit, but I wanted to bring that up. My students often get that question wrong when I ask them, when do you start HIV screening? My guess is that it might seem like 15 is a little too young, but it is surely not. So go check out those recommendations on who should be screened and when. Okay, so who is at risk for HIV infection? Regardless of a patient's sexual or gender identity, we have some risk factors for sexual transmission. So people who live in areas with high HIV incidence, who are not using barrier protection consistently, either they're unwilling, unable, or can't negotiate with their partners for whatever reason. People who live with a recent diagnosis of a bacterial STI, have anal intercourse, engage in transactional sex, so sex for money, drugs, or housing, have partners who are at high risk for unsuppressed HIV, so partners with social and institutional barriers to maybe HIV testing or treatment, people who have more than one sexual partner, and people whose partners have more than one sexual partner. So a lot of different people that you would consider who are at risk for getting HIV. We're going to talk about two meds today. Both are once daily. Sometimes they're used in non-approved ways. We'll talk about that in a second. We're talking about emtricitabine, tenofovir, disoproxil, fumarate. We're going to call it FTDF. It's for adults and adolescents who weigh at least 35 kilograms or 77 pounds. And emtricitabine, tenofovir, allafenamide, FTAF. And that was just approved in late 2019. This is also for adults and adolescents, but excluding those who are at risk through receptive vaginal intercourse. And right now, it's just because we don't have enough evidence to say that there's a clinical difference. Some people have noted that PrEP as a med might make unsafe sexual practices permissible. That's kind of been an argument maybe to not use it and something to use in a stigmatizing way. What we know is that people on PrEP have more diagnosis of STI, but they're screened more often, and when they're screened at a single time, they have similar or only slightly increased rates. But PrEP in the context of overall sexual health should be considered, not just the lack of STIs. Counseling on safe sex alone is unlikely to change behaviors that could significantly reduce patients' risk of HIV. The authors aren't saying don't counsel on safe sex, just that it's not a magical fix, that you can't just say, oh, here's how to have safe sex, and then you won't get HIV. No. Okay, who should take PrEP? Sexually active men who have sex with men who are in a sexual relationship with a partner living with HIV, have a high number of sex partners, have anal intercourse with inconsistent condom use, STI with syphilis, gonorrhea, or chlamydia in the past 6 months, or who do commercial sex work. Sexually active heterosexual women and men in a sexual relationship with a partner living with HIV, high number of sex partners, inconsistent or no condom use, commercial sex work, high HIV prevalence area or network. IV drug users, who have an HIV positive injecting partner, share any injection equipment, or have risk of sexual acquisition. And then I like this note, and this is all from Table 1, indications for PrEP, that sexually and gender diverse persons are understudied in the literature. The CDC recommends considering PrEP in all persons at risk for sexually acquiring HIV, but studies are underpowered in transgender women and have mostly excluded transgender men, gender fluid, two-spirit, and non-binary people. So here's the monitoring that we need to do. That's from table two, the monitoring recommendations. First of all, at all visits, review risk reduction options and PrEP adherence counseling. Discuss using PrEP in pregnancy if the person has childbearing potential. So HIV antibodies at baseline and every 3 months after discontinuing therapy. Additional HIV RNA viral load if the patient has symptoms of acute infection or history of sex with an HIV positive partner in the previous month. We also need creatinine clearance at baseline, 3 months, and then every 6 months. And that monitoring is going to be necessary. It may not be required as frequently in the newer med FTAF. Pregnancy testing we're going to need at baseline every 3 months and then after discontinuing. HBV screening, so Hep B screening at baseline, either vaccinate or continue to monitor if the person's not immune. Hep C screening at baseline and annually. STI screening at baseline and then every 3 to 6 months, but it looks like every 3 months might be better, the authors point out. It catches a lot more of those asymptomatic people. And you may consider less frequent screening though in low-risk patients, such as those in known monogamous and serodisconcordant relationships. So the dosing of PrEP is really approved once a day, but some people use 2 tablets 2 to 24 hours before sex and then 1 tablet 24 hours and 48 hours each. So it's a 2-1-1 dosing. It's not approved that way, but it's used that way sometimes. Compared with daily dosing, the efficacy seems okay. Similar efficacy, but that was a really small study. Sometimes people deviate from the approved schedule of once daily to reduce costs or side effects, like using the T's and S's pattern. So that's taking PrEP on the days of the week that starts with T's or S's, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, Sunday, not recommended by the CDC or the authors. Your patient may not tell you if they're taking their PrEP in these ways. So it's something that you need to know occurs and to talk about. Cost can be a barrier. Medicare does cover it, but if you're not insured, the cash price is $1,845 a month. Transgender women and transgender adults of color are more likely to be uninsured. Costs are always a consideration. Ask if someone can afford everything that you write, but in this case. In summary, this is a revolutionary medication. If you aren't yet, get a little more comfortable with PrEP and having PrEP conversations. PAs in primary care, internal med, and infectious disease are especially well-placed to be optimal prescribers. I love this article. I really learned a lot from it.
Yeah, especially if you're on the primary care front lines, this is definitely something that is well within your practice patterns to be able to manage. Oh, yeah. When you think about... Yeah. How busy infectious disease services are or infectious disease clinics that specialize in HIV, having a patient needing to go to that provider once a month to get, you know, PrEP or PEP therapy when they're seeing patients who could potentially have active HIV or other serious conditions that they need to have those times for the HIV specialists to see. When all they need is just some, screening labs every so often, counseling about safe sexual practices, answering questions, and following up. That's what we do in primary care. So this is just another thing that we put in our, public health belt of this is what your primary care providers can do. So I agree. This is something that we should all be well versed on.
Yeah, you can feel comfortable learning more about it and doing it. I feel like it's. If you're not talking about it, it's akin to not offering immunizations, not even offering, but saying that someone should take it. This is something that we have that can prevent an infection that we, you know, as a kid from the 80s, this was just devastating. We have so many advances now, and to not use it, it would be like saying, you know, it's okay if you get something that's vaccine preventable. Mm-hmm. So I'm really glad that it was there.
Yep, absolutely. Great article. Moving on to the second CME article, this is the role of percutaneous coronary intervention in managing patients with stable ischemic disease by authors Tara Herbert, who practices as a hospitalist at Yale New Haven Hospital in New Haven, Connecticut, and Denise Rizzolo, assistant clinical professor at the PACE Completion Program at New York City and assessment specialist for PAEA. So just a quick understanding of what PCI is. It's used as emergent and urgent intervention for acute coronary syndrome, but more and more institutions are using it in stable disease. And when you have stable ischemic heart disease, it's not the first go-to in your testing and in your risk stratification. The first step is cardiac stress testing. And unfortunately, the review of the data shows that only about 50% of patients have stress testing done before moving on to PCI. If there's ischemia that is present on that cardiac stress testing, then you move to goal-directed medical therapy. And there's great tables in the article that you should go check out that shows you exactly how and what meds to use and how aggressive you need to be in management. If there's a high-risk coronary lesion that is identified on the cardiac stress test, then that is an indication for undergoing PCI with vascularization. So what I learned from this was that a PCI or doing a routine cath is not anywhere in the screening in patients with stable ischemic heart disease. It's a step in the diagnostic algorithm, but first is cardiac stress testing. Even if they have ischemia that's present on that, then it's maximal gold medical therapy. And then only if they have a high-risk coronary lesion do they then progress to having PCIs. So when you're looking at the goal-directed medical therapy, it revolves around lipid management, blood pressure management, physical activity, weight management, smoking cessation, antiplatelet therapy, plus or minus beta blockers, plus or minus using a renin-angiotensin aldosterone inhibitor, and keeping up with the screening tests that you do for managing that. So again, a lot of the lifestyle modifications and the things that we should be doing in routine primary care are all addressed in this goal-directed medical therapy that should be done in patients with stable heart disease before you even think about moving on to having a catheterization done. So having said all that, what are the indications for PCI? So obviously, as I said at the very beginning of this segment, it's an emergent or urgent procedure that we do for ACS. So obviously patients with STEMI, patients with NSTEMIs are all those are indications for PCI because they can find the lesion, stent the lesion, revascularize, save heart tissue. Now, if it's stable ischemic heart disease, then if it's a high-risk lesion, we said, then it's an indication for PCI. So what does that mean? So if they've got a left main coronary stenosis of 50% or greater, and the patient's not a surgical candidate for bypass, then PCI would be indicated. Or if stable angina becomes unacceptable, compromising the patient's quality of life, or a coronary stenosis of 70% or more, or with a fractional flow reserve of 0.8 or less. And the fractional flow reserve is the maximal flow through a stenosed coronary compared to the hypothetical maximal flow through a non-stenosed coronary. And this is a calculation that is typically done prior to having the catheterization. It's just due to some algorithms and some other stuff. They talk a little bit more about it in the article if you want to dive into it. But those are really the only indications in patients with stable heart disease that then require a PCI. Now, where did all this come from? So there were three big studies that were done that showed this: the COURAGE study, the BARI 2D study, and the FAME 2 trial. The COURAGE study showed no differences in primary endpoints at 5 years compared with early PCI versus maximal goal-directed therapy, medical goal-directed therapy. The BARI 2D study showed no differences in major cardiovascular events at 5 years, and the FAME 2 trial showed no difference in anginal symptoms at 5 years. So basically, goal-directed medical therapy is just as good as goal-directed medical therapy and PCI combined. So if that's the case, we're saving a ton of money because about $15,000 is a payout for payout from Medicaid, and I'm sorry, payout for Medicare for a PCI. So $15,000 is what a hospital is making on a PCI, and there is a 5% complication risk in patients with non-emergent for a non-emergent PCI. So not an inconsequential risk of performing the procedure, and obviously in institutions, when they're looking at a $15,000 payout per cath, you can see why only 50% of patients are getting cardiac stress testing first. And I think we're going down a dangerous road that we saw 15 years ago with bariatric surgery, 10 years ago with the ophthalmologists and cataract surgeries, where when you're getting a good chunk of money to perform these procedures and potentially surgeries, it's easy to then get a little loosey-goosey on the recommendations in order for the payouts. But when you have a complication from a non-emergent cath, it might change how your practice is performed. So this is a great study. Highlighted some things that I didn't really know a lot about, especially from my work in emergency medicine, where everything that I saw was typically urgent or emergent, but really opened my eyes to what we should be doing from a primary care standpoint.
Time and time again, we see how important primary care is in preventing and not waiting until we need an urgent or emergent procedure that's more expensive, but that's the way that our system is set up and what makes people the most money. I love a less is more article, and I think that's what this is saying. It's not easier. Like blood pressure management, physical activity, weight management, smoking cessation, antiplatelet therapy, lipid management, beta blockers, that's not zero effort on the part of the patient or the provider. ACEs, flu vaccine, right? But it's not zero effort, but in one way, it's a less is more. Let's be less happy to jump in and do something interventional. And let's be happier to charge less money. Time and time again, we see how much the U.S. pays for healthcare services and our quality generally plummeting.
Yeah.
We had this conversation not long ago about dialysis, about renal dialysis, how intraperitoneal, non-inferior. It's not right for everyone, but it costs so much less.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we kind of just get into these patterns of, well, this is what we do. But I hope that this article, it definitely helped me re-examine how much PCI we might really need to do.
Well, and one of the things that I learned from a interventional cardiologist that I worked with at my previous institution is he said that, the coronaries that are going to show up as stenosed on cats are the ones that usually cause anginal symptoms. So the ones that spontaneously thrombose and cause AMIs and potential mortality are the ones that are typically 30% or less, because the larger stenosed arteries tend to be more stable and they tend to be harder, so they don't rupture as much. So he said doing cats only help anginal symptoms if we revascularize. It doesn't do anything for mortality and morbidity. So now you're talking about doing procedures on patients where all you're doing is looking at what's the percentage of flow. And let's just say it's a vessel that's 35%. Do you stent that? Well, you don't really need to, because that's not going to cause any anginal symptoms. So what did you do? You just did a $15,000 procedure on somebody and did no intervention that is going to improve their quality of life and or improve their mortality, as opposed to all of the medical therapies that we know have very good endpoints to show that not only does it improve mortality, but it improves quality of life. It's fascinating.
Yeah. It's getting stuck on disease-oriented evidence, DOE, instead of patient-oriented evidence. Do we do something that helps a person live a longer, happier life, or did we just change a number? Oh, man, EBM. Yep. It always comes back to that.
Yep.
It always comes back to that. QRS. I love a QRS. These are going to be quicker. Thanks for sticking with us. Schizophrenia and Schizophrenia Spectrum Disorders by Matthew Wright, PAC. He's a faculty member in the PA program at Rutgers, just across the river from me in Piscataway, New Jersey, and works clinically in family medicine in Hunterdon County, New Jersey. No conflicts of interest. Schizophrenia and schizophrenia spectrum disorders are psychotic disorders. They have positive, negative, and disorganized symptoms that cause impaired function for the person. The typical onset is in younger adults, 18 to 25 in men, 21 to 30 in women, but you can see there's an overlap there in the early 20s. There's a worse prognosis in men, people who have lower intelligence and those with earlier onset of their symptoms. And we don't exactly know what causes it specifically, because it's multifactorial: genetics, environment, neurodevelopmental, and neurotransmitter components. We have a DSM-5, of course, and criteria, and they are this. If symptoms have been present for at least 1 month, shorter if therapy is initiated, right? So you see symptoms, you give them therapy, their symptoms stop. It's not because they're self-limited. It's because you started therapy. If patients have two of the following: hallucinations, delusions, disorganized speech, disorganized or catatonic behavior, or other negative symptoms. This is the active phase or acute psychosis. During this month, at least one symptom must be hallucinations, delusions, or disorganized speech. You have to seek dysfunction in work, social life, or self-care. And these disturbances have to persist for 6 months, including the 1 month active phase of psychosis. No major mood symptoms occurred during the active phase, or if they were there, just for a minority of the time. Also, symptoms are not from a medical condition or substance abuse. Delusions and hallucinations must be prominent if there has been a diagnosis of autism spectrum or communication disorder. And the differentials could be delusional disorder, a false belief despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary. Brief psychotic disorder is another differential. That's acute psychosis lasting up to a month. Schizoaffective disorder, that's active phase symptoms with mood episodes such as depression or mania. So schizoaffective symptoms with mood symptoms, that would be schizoaffective disorder. And in patients with schizoaffective disorder, patients also have to experience a 2-week period with hallucinations or delusions, but without the mood symptoms. We also have schizophreniform disorder. That's schizophrenia symptoms that persist for more than a month, but less than 6. So maybe you're catching someone before you can give them an official diagnosis of schizophrenia. And these patients do normally develop schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, or a mood disorder. You should also think about bipolar disorder, but that's mostly a mood disturbance. It's and mood disturbances are not characteristics of schizophrenia, but someone with bipolar disorder can have psychotic features, and acute mania could mimic positive symptoms, and depression could mimic negative symptoms. So just keep that in mind. We treat schizophrenia and schizophrenia spectrum disorders with antipsychotics, first or second generation, first often referred to as typical antipsychotics, and second generation atypical. First generation more likely to cause your tardive dyskinesia, dystonia, pseudo-Parkinsonism. Atypicals, the second generation, more likely to cause metabolic syndrome, so lipid and glucose abnormalities, weight gain. So you have to monitor those things. And the atypical clozapine can cause agranulocytosis, putting people more at risk for infection. So you also need CBC monitoring there, looking at those white blood cells. But consider, we did cover, so I want to go back and say sometimes clozapine isn't something that people will choose right off the bat because of that agranulocytosis, but we covered an article about the importance of sleep in schizophrenia a while back now, and how atypicals can change your sleep architecture, so basically the patterns of you going through your REM cycles and sleeping, and clozapine had some evidence that it had a good sleep profile, which can help. So look more into that if you're someone who's going to write these meds, because clozapine maybe has some more pros than we thought. That article doesn't say that. I'm saying that. That's my editorializing, pulling in some information that we learned a while back. But I thought this was a really important article, because anytime we can destigmatize a mental health disorders and know how we can help people, I'm all for that.
Yep. It's a tough condition to manage, obviously, because it's one of the classic ones where when a patient with schizophrenia is in active psychosis, it's easy to identify, it's easy to treat, but then when you're treating it and they feel better, then they're more likely then to not take their medicines because of the side effect, because they say, oh, well, I'm feeling better now. And unfortunately, it is a cycle of ebb and flow, of peaks and valleys. And so this was a nice review just to keep us on the forefront of making sure that we understand how to catch this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Last one we're going to talk about real quick is managing acute cancer pain. This is by author Robin Sears, PAC and assistant professor at the PA program at Midwestern University in Glendale, Arizona. 66% of patients with cancer will experience some form of acute pain, and multiple studies have shown that pain is undertreated in the hospital across all subspecialties, and less than 20% of providers are trained in appropriate and effective use of opioids. So you're talking about a bunch of subspecialists and a bunch of providers in the hospital who are trained to take care of patients with cancer, but only one in five actually know and are trained in using opioids effectively in treating said pain. So the author definitely advocates for consulting experts, and using an interprofessionary collaboration is absolutely vital in making sure that the patients are being taken care of to our utmost ability. There's a study that showed that oncologists self-rated their ability to manage cancer pain as a 7 out of 10, but their objective performance in patient scenarios were graded as unacceptable by their peers and other pain management specialists. So these are the doctors and providers who are going to be taking care of patients with cancer, and they might have a little bit of Dunning-Kruger in that they feel like they're doing a much better job than what they're objectively being graded by their peers and other people who are good at prescribing opioids and treating pain. So it's something that you should open up your eyes and your biases of saying, you know, maybe we need to bring some people on board with this case to make sure that we're treating this pain appropriately. There's a bunch of
Dunning-Kruger. Oh, sorry. Oh. We can talk about Dunning-Kruger in a second.
Okay. Interventional options that are also helpful outside of just medications include nerve and plexus blocks, where they start with local anesthetics and they inject into the areas where the nerves are supplying certain regions. And if they're successful, then you can discuss using a neurolytic agent in order to completely destroy the nerve and the pain sensation. Obviously, there's a significant amount of motor and sensory loss that can occur with that. There's also neuraxial blocks with intrathecal pumps, where they're injecting a slow, continuous stream of medications into those sections. It's best for patients with more than a six-month life expectancy because of the complications that occur with it. There's also spinal cord stimulator implants that disrupt the signal transmission from the nervous system. There's a higher risk for infectious complications, but really good evidence to support their use in treating acute pain. Now, the article goes into much more detail about all of these, and I highly recommend you going and checking that out if you're a PA who is taking care of patients with cancer pain. But it's definitely eye-opening that, you know, the specialists who are admitting patients with cancer aren't as good as they think they are in managing said cancer pain.
Yeah, as soon as you said that, I was like, Dunning-Kruger, and that's the, what is it, a phenomenon?
I think it's a phenomenon.
Construct?
Yeah.
Where when you don't know anything, generally you know you don't know anything. But when you learn a little bit more, you're like, oh my gosh, I'm an expert. I know so much about this. And that's a dangerous mix of a little bit of knowledge and a lot of confidence, where a lot of errors can sneak in. And then as you learn more, you look back and say, oh, I actually didn't know much as I thought I did. And so that confidence, as someone learns more about a topic, experts can generally look back and see how much they really don't know. And I hope that I can do that every day in my decisions, or at least at the end of the day, and reflect, how many times did I think I knew more than I did? How much do I not know? I hope that's something I can practice as much as possible.
I concur.
I know I don't always as much as I should, but I'm going to keep working on it. I also just want to take one extra minute. We never do this. We cover four articles and we go forward, but there was a great article, if you get the chance to look at it, please do, Using Interpreters for Deaf Patients and Patients with Limited English Proficiency by PA Dr. Heather Brown. It's on page 42 in the print journal. Just want to draw your attention to the needs of our deaf patients and those with hearing losses as a population in need of interpreters, along with those for whom English is not their preferred language. And I want to thank Dr. Brown for writing that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that does it for us. We are all over social media. I'm at PA_Mede. Adrian is at The Art of EVM. JAPA is at JAPA Online. And Harrison Reed, our interim editor-in-chief of JAPA, is at Harrison Reed PA.
Mm-hmm. And credits go out to Chris Mede, who does sound and sound engineering. If you haven't subscribed to our feeds on Stitcher and iTunes, please subscribe and please give us a rating.
Until next time.
Bye.
Bye.